Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host, researcher, and friend, Jenny McGrath, founder of Endwell Movement. Jenny, it's good to be back and to talk about all things YWAM, Youth with a Mission. I've been receiving some emails, and you've probably seen it in the contact feeds, people who are wondering, how bad is it? What is it like? Are all groups the same? And some of them are asking me, how can I tell if my son or daughter, whenever they get back, how can I tell if they have been impacted by all of this that you're talking about? And that's an interesting question, because a lot of it carries over to some of the other groups that I've been researching. I get the similar question the moment I publish anything that's a little bit critical of a movement. The parents all cry out, well, what about my kid? What about and rightfully so. I would be the same way. So I thought maybe it would be good to just take a break from the things we've been talking about and discuss, how can you tell if somebody has been impacted by a destructive cult? And that will probably cover all bases, because we have we have different groups of people who are listening. So with that, hopefully I've given you enough context for what I'm wanting to achieve, and we can help some parents to calm some fears.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I just want to appreciate the concern that's there. Of course, we never want our loved ones, especially children, to be in places where they're being psychologically or emotionally harmed. And I'm going to start by probably not dispelling too much fear, and then we'll hopefully dispel some fear. But I would say it's really hard to tell. Because if someone had asked me when I was in YWAM, is this harming you, or are you being affected by this? I would have said, no way. This is exactly where I'm supposed to be. Of course, it's hard, but that's just part of the mission. And it's been the further distance I've gotten from the organization and the work that I've been able to reflect on really how it was impacting me. And so I know that that might sound troubling, that it actually can be hard to tell, because it could be hard for the child or the person that you love who's in this world to be able to parse out what is happening internally and what is being influenced by the organization.
I would agree. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast. Whenever I was 16 years old, I was in high school, and we had to take these personality tests and it was a test to discover your emotion so that you could work with a counselor within the school. I can't remember the name of the test. You might be familiar with this. But anyway, I took this test, and the answers, I was answering every question as though I had no stress or no issue at all. And the teacher thought I was crazy. Number one, they thought I was lying. They said, nobody your age has zero stress. And I said, well, I don't. I can't really think of anything. I'm kind of a happy-go-lucky person. Years later, I realized that I had so many stresses that I had more stresses probably than every other person in that classroom. And I was suppressing my stress and emotion and just putting it off to the side in my brain and trying to pretend that it wasn't there, kind of like a child whistling as they go through the graveyard, right? Years later, I find out that I had all of these stresses, and it was impacting me in ways that I didn't even realize. So if I had have been putting myself as an example and say that wasn't my parents that got me in this, but I left the group and my parents said, did this harm you? I would say, absolutely not. I'm perfectly fine. I'm happy-go-lucky. I have 0% stress. And most parents are not going to ask a question if you say, I have no stress. My first advice is, if that's the case, you might want to dig a little bit deeper, because they may be like me and just putting it off to the side.
I think that's a great point. And I was similar. I had so many people ask me, you know, how are you so joyful all of the time? How are you so happy? And that's been a big challenge for people in my world. The more that I've come out about the harm that I've experienced is this confusion, like, well, you were always so happy. And trying to educate people, you know, what I felt able to show on the outside wasn't always what I was experiencing on the inside. And, you know, from a developmental psychological perspective, by the time we are 1 year old, we can tell what emotions will get an adverse reaction. And so a lot of us, even pre-verbally and pre-consciously, have learned to suppress our emotions. And so what I want to be careful is I'm not like drawing this direct correlation and blaming parents and saying it's your fault if your kids end up in YWAM and are harmed. And there is some type of nervous system that tends to be drawn to these missionary martyr positions because it's familiar. If I had not had a lifetime of abdicating my own needs, my own desires, I would have had a much bigger reaction when I got to the winter in Montana and found out I was taking misty cold showers all winter. And I would have been like, what the heck? This isn't what my body needs. But by that point, even as an 18-year-old, I was so used to turning off my own needs and my own desires. And so I think that that can be a really hard thing to hold, and not to, you know, of course, we're talking about the problems of YWAM, but I think it's a much broader question of how are we taking care of our own nervous systems and bodies? Is there space in me for anger, for sadness, for grief? And if there's not, how is that going to impact my child or my loved one and their ability to express anger or sadness or grief? And so I kind of even want to turn it back a little bit and to say, am I okay? Am I okay in the spectrum of my emotions and my humanity and the things that make me? Or do I feel like I am performing to fit into different religious or social places?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, because one of the mistakes made by a lot of people who've never experienced a cult is those, if you were to ask them, was the child impacted, their first thought would be, is the child weird? Because people who join cults are weird. That's usually where they go, because their only frame of reference is what you see in Hollywood, and they're pretty weird, the cults in Hollywood. But it's not quite like that. There are so many people who are in a destructive group and have no idea, and they may seem like normal people, but if you really get deep inside their personality, it's more about, are their decisions shaped by chronic fear? Are their decisions shaped by the control of the group? Do they have an unhealthy isolationist mindset? Or are they trying to suppress their identity to conform to a group? And there's some weird boundaries there, because depending on the type of Christianity that the person is in who is wanting to know, if they're on the more fundamentalist side, they may be fully familiar with all of the control. And yet you couldn't necessarily say that they're in a cult. They're just in a more controlling type of religion. And on the other side of the spectrum, you may have somebody who's just so liberal that they don't think of religion at all. And so you've got this wide variety of people. So how do you know what is normal and what is weird? So the question, I would ask is, dig into your own life just a little bit to see what it is that you believe and why. But learn if that is healthy before confronting the child, the son or daughter who is in the group, because they may actually be more normal than you, having exited a cult, which is ironic if you think about it.
Totally. Yeah. And as you talk about that, you know, I am pretty firmly convinced that we are feeling beings who think, not thinking beings who feel. And so even our beliefs and the way that we look at the world are so impacted by the state of our nervous system. And so even before or during or as someone's asking, what are my beliefs? I would even say, what's my breath doing right now. Am I able to take a deep, slow belly breath? And that can tell us so much about the state of our nervous system and our body, because our nervous system cannot differentiate the stress of high control religion and the stress of being chased by a lion. And so asking, like, do I feel the ability and the freedom to eat a sandwich and just hang out on a rock and enjoy nature? Or do I find that my mind always is needing to stay busy and trying to figure things out? Rather than just looking at the mind, I think it's so important to sink deeper into what is the nervous system doing that is causing the mind to find reasons to feel the way that we feel.
Yeah, absolutely. The only caveat would be I have severe allergies. That's why I clear my throat all of the time. I can't just breathe like this, but I know exactly what you're talking about. Anxiety is a key pressure, and I struggle with anxiety. In the past, I've had to be very cautious of the situations I allowed myself to get into so that I didn't overdo the anxiety. And so I think that's a point too. The parents who are worried about their son or daughter having left one of these groups, if they suffer anxiety, their anxiety can transfer sometimes. And so it might even bring more stress if you ask incorrectly. So I think the healthy way for me, if I were to sit down and look at a person and see, have they been impacted by a cult, I wouldn't first ask them anything about the doctrines of the cult, or there are people who are researching who are asking me questions about Youth with a Mission specifically, because they have heard some of the things and started digging into some of the bases that may or may not have issues. That's their area of research. And they try to project that on somebody who may not have even been at that base. That's going to immediately bring up the defenses, whether the person has been impacted negatively or positively by the group. So you have to instead look at the personality of the person. Has the personality changed? Is this the same person that you remember when they left and started going to the group? Does that person change? And if so, have they changed in a positive way? Have they changed in a negative way? Or have they become distant in a way that you can't really explain?
Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, the invitation of Jesus that says, you know, look at the log in your own eye before trying to get the speck out of the other ones. I think an important inquiry is, how do I make myself someone that feels safe for someone to talk to if they're not in a good place? And I think Rezma Menakem talks in My Grandmother's Hands. It's a beautiful book about how settled bodies settle bodies. And a lot of times, if you're in this world of certain bases, certain cultures in YWAM, where everything is about the mission and it's about getting it done, it's a heightened nervous system state. And so it can actually be kind of unsettling, but an invitation to be in the presence of someone that is able to feel a little bit more grounded and a little bit more calm. With, of course, I love the caveats that you're giving, is that we live in a world where our brains, our nervous systems function differently. And I don't want to skew this to this idea of healthism that says an individual body, quote unquote, should be restful. But how do we have curiosity for the ways in which our bodies and our minds have needed to potentially adapt by not resting? And can we allow maybe even 5% more space in our bodies as we're thinking about people and bases and these different systems? Like, how can we be those types of people, you know? And as you've mentioned, people reaching out to you, I've had people reach out to me, even just from us having these conversations. And so I think laying out the conversation on a table and letting people that are need to or that are ready to come and start to talk about it.
And there are some points that I think may be bordering doctrinal conversations that you can have, such as we've talked about this before, the black and the white mentality. Whenever you begin to talk to them, if they instantly turn into if the conversation instantly turns into a very black or white, us versus them, good versus evil, usually something's not quite right, because the world has good and evil, but it's filled with all of these varying shades of gray. And the person who has not been impacted by a destructive group will think through the grays. And that's usually where conversations head, because they're trying to learn, well, how do I navigate the gray? But a cult will usually stop you right there. It's either black or white, good versus bad, us versus them, especially if it's an us versus them conversation that it turns to. And you can tell very quickly whenever somebody has been impacted in that way, because if you say anything that makes them bring their guard or their defenses up, that cult identity starts to surface, they'll instantly turn into a black or white conversation. I remember after leaving the group, I started talking to a friend. We were talking about something that we both had in common, some sport or some, might have been video games, and they just lit up. They were just an open book. We could talk. We had this great conversation. But the moment it shifted to something that they thought that I was going to speak critically, which I didn't, that was when their defenses came up, and instantly they just, you could almost see the eyes glaze over. It was a different person that was talking to you.
You know, even some comments that have come up on these videos is, I've had a positive experience in YWAM, or people I know that have had a positive experience, and it feels like it has to be, is YWAM good? Is YWAM bad? And part of the complexity in that shade of gray and nuance is that there is no structure to the organization intentionally. And so as we're talking about different bases, or even different experiences in different bases, can have different effects on people based on personality, based on how invested they were, based on a million different things. And you know, I am a mental health counselor. I work primarily with adults who have experienced childhood sexual abuse. And this is happens on an individual familial level as well, where often sometimes someone will come forward and talk about their perpetration, and other people will say, well, that person never abused me. And it's like, well, okay, that's great. And that doesn't mean that that person didn't harm this other person. And perpetrators of violence in any form might not be perpetrating that same violence to everyone all the time. And so I think that's why it's so important for us to hold those spaces of complexity and nuance to say, great, I'm glad you had a wonderful experience in YWAM. And that's not exactly what we're talking about as we're trying to unpack the harm that has also happened.
Absolutely. The other thing that it gets a little bit tricky trying to distinguish this between somebody that hasn't been impacted, but depending on the age that they joined Youth with a Mission or any of the other groups, if they joined at an early enough age where they were still going through child development, there is a change in the way that the development patterns exist. And that change, usually in the more destructive groups, everything becomes over-spiritualized. So the developmental freedoms that the person may have had as they're forming their life's, their view of life and how the world around them works, often they will bring it into the spiritual realm instead of what they are actually experiencing. So whenever they're talking and then suddenly you're talking about something that is literally a physical place, a physical state of mind, a physical place that you have in common with them, or a state of mind that you did recognize before they left, whenever that turns into angels or demons or weird things that just doesn't make sense to a, from a Christian standpoint, they've taken it basically out of reality and into a spiritual plane. Whenever that happens, you can see that they're probably impacted by some sort of religious indoctrination at minimum, but usually a destructive group.
Yeah, just the sense of, as you named, reality. Can this person be here now? Or is there so much fantasy and imagination and fear? You know, I spent so many years, and this predated YWAM because of the world I grew up in and how much of evangelicalism has been influenced by the Left Behind series, getting confused with Christian doctrine. And so, you know, I was so afraid to even go to a movie or have a nice meal or do anything that I thought was enjoyable or pleasurable because Jesus was going to come back in any second and I didn't want him to see me doing something that was just what I wanted to do. And so I think about that as like, is this person able to just live life the way that Jesus did? Like, he took naps, he had parties, he hung out in gardens. Like, what a way to live, and how aligned am I able to be with that image or not?
That reminded me, I actually, as I was thinking through what we would talk about, I didn't think about this one topic, but whenever a person has been influenced in a destructive group, their personality changes, but it's more than just a personality change. The things that they used to enjoy, sometimes they are trained to be condemned by those things. You're talking about the movies, for example. Interestingly, about the same time I was mentioning, I was probably about 16, I had a good friend who had joined, I'm not going to say which, but had joined another cult. And it was really odd now thinking back, because I was in one and he was in one, but they were different cults. And he had joined and he'd went away for a period of time. I guess he went on some sort of a mission. When he came back, he was a different person and I couldn't put my finger on it. He before was somebody that I really looked up to as a solid person, but when he came back, he seemed to regret everything. He was just filled with chronic shame, sadness. His outlook on life had changed so significantly that I really didn't recognize him. I could look at him, I could talk to him, he was the same person, but he was just so filled with internal guilt. And it's odd because I have met Christians who went to churches that I would not even say was a cult, but they to some degree get the same thing if the group is really I guess controlling is probably the word. If the group is really controlling, they will try to instill this guilt, and the religion itself is associated with guilt. So internally, they start to develop this idea that everything that they do is wrong. Well, that's how my friend was, and I didn't recognize him. I think as a parent, you might catch that they're different, but you might not catch that they're feeling guilty on the inside.
Yeah. What comes to mind as you talk about that is I don't think anyone in my life would have said I felt guilty, and I was drowning in guilt. And it is so sad for me to go back and, you know, I have dozens and dozens and dozens of journals that were prayer journals. And almost every single entry starts out with, "Dear God, I'm sorry. Fill in the blank." And most of the time it was like, "I'm sorry I haven't been spending enough time with you. I'm sorry I haven't had enough quiet times. I'm sorry I haven't been praying enough." And there was never an enough. Like, there was never a week. It was like, yep, I did everything Christian enough I should have done this week. But I kind of hid all of those truths even from myself, and then I just put them in these journals, but I was feeling it. And yet I felt part of what we've talked about before is that there's this veneer of YWAM and evangelical Christianity that says you have to be happy. And I have a brilliant colleague, Liv Schultz, who has done research and written a few articles around the positive affect of evangelicalism. And that's the most happy place on earth. And it can be really confusing if internally, especially I think for women who are socialized to be pleasant and demure and happy-go-lucky, if you're really suffering inside, you don't always feel able to show that on the outside.
Exactly. It's, you know, we started attending a church that was, I would not say it was a cult, But one of the things that they were starting to lean heavily towards was that certain emotions that you have as a human are sinful. And I immediately stood up and I said, no. They were talking specifically about anger. And I think I mentioned this on the podcast. I mentioned afterwards, Paul said, in his anger, do not sin. How can you reconcile that? But for me, the problem was specifically that that is a type of control. If they can get you to control your emotions and to make you feel that your emotions are evil, it's a good way to hijack your mind, because that's something a human just simply can't control. When I get angry, I'm angry. I'm not going to stop this. When I get sad, I'm sad. I'm not going to stop this. Whenever a person gets out of one of these groups and they're wrestling with their own emotions or anything that is incontrollable in the human body, that's, for me, that's a sign that they have been in something that's pretty destructive.
And one of the devastating things for me about that is I'm thinking about Gabor Mate's work, When the Body Says No, and the different correlations. Again, I never want to say this is causing this, but I will say there is a very strong correlation between suppressing emotions and true self with autoimmune disorders, because the body has all of this energy. You know, our word energy or emotion is literally energy in motion. And if we don't have a freedom to give motion to our emotions, then it becomes this energy pack in our body. And it's like a nuclear reactor that inevitably will wreak havoc on our nervous systems if we don't have ways of expressing and letting out that anger, that grief, even the guilt, whatever we're feeling that can be a normal human emotion. If we feel like we have to hide it, that really is so difficult for our bodies.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So let's talk for a moment about what a parent should do if their son or daughter comes back from one of these groups and they suspect that there's something different about them. And their first thought immediately after hearing one of our podcasts was, oh my gosh, were they in one of the more destructive groups, or were they in something that was somewhat benign? I think it's really important how you address it, because as a parent, you want to stay connected to your son or daughter, but if handled improperly, I think there is a risk that you can cause the relationship to become either distant or sometimes even severed. So let's talk through the points of what should I do if I'm a parent and this happens to my son or daughter. What are the first steps you would do?
The first step I would say is be curious. You know, like I would be gone for maybe 5, 6, 9, 18 months, and I would get back and people would go, how was it? And that was probably one, if not the only question that they would ask. And so I think that really making time to go, what were you learning? Tell me about your teachers. What was your day-to-day like? What types of food did you eat? And just ask really kind of mundane but important questions to really try to understand what the experience was like. And what you might notice is that there is a defensiveness. You might notice that there's a denial. You might notice that they're like, I had a great time. But I think being curious is so, so, so important, because one of the biggest ways that cults tend to work is isolation and seclusion. And the experience in YWAM is pretty explicit. That's like, people won't understand what this is like. And so I think even saying something like, I know I wasn't there with you, but I really would like to try to understand what your experience was. Can we take an afternoon and I ask you some questions about it? And then do that multiple times. So you can never ask too many questions about what the experience was like.
Exactly. The last thing you want to do is to be confrontational, especially about doctrine, because if they were in a destructive group, that immediately gets their guard up. You want to first try to speak to their person, because even if they were impacted negatively in a destructive cult, their cult identity, especially when they start to be around you as the parent, your cult identity is relaxed. Unless you get confrontational, they start to show their authentic self, and you may actually not even be able to see any issues because their authentic self is talking to you. But the first thing to do is just to try to distinguish between the person that came back to see you and the person that left. Have they been able to grow and develop their personal being? Do they seem like without the group they are struggling to survive? Do they feel like they need to get plugged back into the group immediately? There are different ways that you can do this, but the easiest way is to just start talking to them about things that you had in common with them in the past, and bring their memory back to that place where you were before, and then watch what happens. As you continue to talk, do they instantly open up, or do they suddenly start feeling guilty that they're having these memories and those memories aren't associated with the group?
Yeah, I think even if there were good relationships that existed before their time in these organizations, being like, now that you're back, have you called so-and-so, or did you keep up with this person while you were gone? Because I think so often the experience is to just cut ties with former life. And of course, that is sometimes more complex if the former life was also harmful and there were ties that need to be cut. So I'm not saying you should stay in relationship with everyone all the time, but having some sense of curiosity about what are the relations outside of this organization, both past and present, that are able to take place? Are they able to go socialize with people, or do they feel like they need to stay insular in this world?
And the next point for me is a bit ironic, because I'm being a little bit guarded of what I say and how on this podcast, if you can't already tell. But that's actually a sign that somebody has been in a destructive cult, but for different reasons. I'm being guarded because, number one, not every group that I'm talking about or researching on my website is a cult. So I want to be careful how I talk. But number two, I want to say things that don't hurt more than help. So I'm being very guarded in my words. And the audience can probably hear this. If your son or daughter does this, however, when they come back to you, that's actually a good sign that something's not quite right. The listener who's hearing me, they're saying, well, that doesn't sound like John. Well, think about you as a parent. That doesn't sound like my kid. What's wrong? Self-guarded language, self-surveillance, I guess is the word. The children kind of monitor their own thoughts whenever they come out of one of these places, because it's not familiar. When they're in the group and they're in the group mindset, the group mentality, there's this comfort in knowing that you're not going outside of the group's will or boundaries. But then when you separate from the group, the problem is, well, what if somebody else does? What if somebody else unknowingly sins? And that's kind of one of the problems. So you'll notice the language is very reserved. They want to say something that doesn't put you in a place where you will sin, and that's one of the things that goes through your head if you're in one of these destructive groups. I remember doing exactly this when I would be around family members who weren't part of the cult. You're trying to talk in such a way that the person you're talking to doesn't do something that offends people who are in the group. And so you've got this multifaceted surveillance. It's not just you, it's the people you're talking to, it's the side parties who are privy to the conversations. And all of that, as you're doing it, the stress level is so insanely high that the person just literally cannot, they can't keep it up. And so they'll become tired, uncomfortable, and an array of problems. They might even not be able to eat. Their stomach may be upset. So watch for the self-surveillance.
Again, from a nervous perspective, are they able to have fun? Like, can you go do a water park or putt-putt golf or just something that is menial and a hobby? Or does it feel like that produces some sense of stress because they, quote unquote, should be working or proselytizing to people? I know for me, as I mentioned, leisure became so hard and it felt sinful to just even rest. And again, this is a place to be careful, because if people had tried to force me into leisure, that wouldn't have helped. But if you can ask, like, hey, how do you feel about this? What would be something that you would enjoy? And it's so complex, because I think, obviously, we want to try to care for people in our lives that are in these worlds. And if someone's in this world, as you said, kind of trying to help them out can almost push them further in. And I don't want then parents or loved ones to feel like they've caused that. And so I think individuation is really important, to say, I care for this person, I want to try to be there, and they are on their own journey. And I'm responsible for my part in this, but I'm not responsible for them. And I think that can be a really healthy way of protecting yourself as you're trying to care for others who are navigating different groups or high control religions.
The other thing that goes along with that, you and I have spoken about this, and I know I've had this conversation with a few different other people. The language itself, whenever they're talking to you, you might pick up on words or phrases that just don't quite seem right, but the person who's speaking, the son or daughter, they put so much emphasis and excitement into that word or phrase, and you're thinking, well, that's, I've heard that word, but I don't know if that word means what you think that means. That's one of the signs. The loaded language is unbelievable. I had this conversation not 2 or 3 days ago. It could be in places that you don't expect it. I struggle sometimes to sit in a church service simply for the loaded language of the Bible book name, chapter number, and verse number. There are certain ones that if you mention, all of this programming goes off in my head, and I have actually had to get up and walk out of a service because of mentioning that book, chapter, and verse, all of that stuff, that explosion, rapid explosions in my head. You can start to see this whenever they're speaking, because the language itself seems more potent than it did before. And they'll use a word or phrase, sometimes they'll repeat that word or phrase because that's what they have been trained to do. And that language is pretty revealing whenever you're a parent, because that's not how they spoke when they left.
Yeah, there's so much, I think, verbiage in YWAM that, honestly, I've been out for 10 years now. Sometimes I don't always remember it until I hear someone say something, or I talk to a friend that's also left, and I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, there was a whole other language that we learned. I'm also thinking about, there were several times I had family members come to visit me while I was on different YWAM bases, and I would be in such distress because I felt like going with them to go do an excursion or a trip was sort of abandoning the school or the mission or the program that I was supposed to be in. And it just felt like such a tether to this organization that my loyalty was to it, and in a very short amount of time. And so I think sometimes even naming things like that, if you see that, like, wow, it seems like you feel really loyal to this, and it seems like you don't feel like you can have much of your own choice without feeling like you're going to be letting people down or failing people. Like, if someone would have said that, I think that would have been probably relieving for me, because I was feeling that way, and I didn't have anyone really mirroring that's what I was experiencing.
So this is going to be a difficult one for me to explain and talk through, and somewhat painful to talk through. Growing up, I remember having conversations with adults, and they would often talk about how mature I was. And I often would connect more with the adults than I would the people my age. Now, in some scenarios, that's not a bad thing. There are children who mature faster. But in a destructive group, one of the problems is that while maturing faster, or seemingly maturing faster, there are underdeveloped aspects of their life. So socially, they may be underdeveloped, but in biblical knowledge, maybe they're more mature. Emotionally, they may be mature or immature, but relationships, they may not even be existent. So you've got all this wide variety of developmental changes in the strength of development. And while the person may seem more mature, like I said, they may be suffering in other areas. I was like this. Socially, I was pretty awkward. I look back, my wife remembers this. The first time I met her, everybody in the group was, you know, having fun, conversation. I'm the guy who's in the corner sipping coffee. That's just how I was. And I've never really been that outgoing, but I was more seclusive than my personality was. But yet I was more mature to the adults. They saw me as mature. And that's because developmentally I wasn't progressing like everyone else. I was in a destructive cult. And a step further, those who were with me in that room, and I'm picturing all of the faces right now, many of them did not struggle in the same way socially. They were all socializing. But I was more, I guess, in tune with the religion. I was listening to these recordings of the cult leader over and over. I was programming my head. I was becoming mature in ways that they weren't, but as it related to the cult. And so the cult men often saw me as more mature. So this is a huge problem, and it's difficult to detect, because how do you recognize if your child has matured in one area and not another? The only way that you can do this really is to explore the different areas and see, how do they act? Do you recognize their maturity level? And is it heightened in one area and decreased in another?
I was 19 years old when I was taking teams of people to rural villages in Africa. And I look at 19-year-olds now and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's no way that you should be doing that at that age. And that is, I think, a big part of the structure of YWAM, is that you do a DTS right after high school, maybe right after college, and then you're leading teams of other people. And I think even just kind of, again, a reflection of, wow, you are really young to be doing all of this. And not in a way that's like puffing someone up and making them feel good, but in a way that's like, how are you doing? Like, what are you needing to like pretend, or how are you needing to puff yourself up to do this thing that you really don't have a lot of experience, much less training, to be able to do?
Again, I feel like I'm self-diagnosing, but with that also is this issue where you, as a person who has been indoctrinated, internally recognized something was wrong with the maturity levels. So socially, when I was engaged in conversation, I was panicking. And in many ways, I would not open up like other people, just simply because I couldn't tolerate things that were not in my control. And because I was in a high control group, and they were telling me what I can do to be saved, to be part of their controlled environment, if I followed those instructions, it was like A, B, C, D, go to heaven. But life isn't really like that when you think about it. So the other areas in my life were just completely neglected. And whenever there was anything that could potentially be controversial, that's whenever I come unglued. I can't control this. I just need to shut it off. So if you notice, and this isn't quite anxiety, it's a little bit different. If you notice that they can't tolerate things that make them have a choice, I think is the best way to say this. If they're confronted with a choice and the choice doesn't have necessarily an answer that the cult has given them, then suddenly you start to watch them panic and you can kind of see it in their face. They may give you an answer, but you can tell that that's not the way that typically somebody of their age would respond.
I'm also thinking about a little bit of a preemptive thing. This is for maybe folks in a different situation whose kids haven't yet gone to YWAM. I remember even when I was in high school, many, many, many years ago, Googling, is YWAM a cult? Before I even went, there was that concern. And that's, you know, even my parents were like, are you joining a cult? And then I hopped on the plane by myself and flew to Montana for my first school. And I would have been mortified if my parents came with me and interviewed the school leaders or talked to them even before I got there. But in hindsight, maybe that would have been a good mortification. And like, and can you risk embarrassing your child in the first place to go, I want to talk to these school leaders. I want to talk to your outreach leader. I want to get a handle on who these people are. Like, if you have a 17, 18, 19 year old trying to go to this program, I think it's really important to still be a parent in that situation and really be protective and really even say, like, I don't actually get a good feeling from this. I'm really concerned about you, or these are the parameters that I want to have in place when you go. I want you to be checking in with me each week. I want to, you know, like, making sure that there is some type of safety net, as much as that child might hate that at the time. I think being able to be proactive is such an important thing for preventing perhaps some situations in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, the bottom line really, can the child be a child? After they leave the group, can they still be the same person? Can they continue to develop? Is this just a milestone in their journey, or was this the major fundamental breaking change in their journey? Did they shift so significantly that they're not the same person and they can't interact once they've left? There's a human nature for most children, and for even young adults, I would say up into their 20s, you want to ask questions, you want to learn, you're asking to learn, you're wanting to increase your information that's packed into your brain. And that's just normal life. When you converse with people, you have conversations that involve questions. Whenever you leave one of these groups, you're a little bit skeptical of questions because there is this underlying theme, you can't question the group. Once they leave the group, well, what can you question? And so developmentally, this really breaks your development. You're not allowed to ask questions. So I would say also, ask them questions, but again, be careful how you ask and what you put boundaries on what you ask them, but then watch if they reciprocate. Are they asking you questions? If they've been disconnected from you for any period of time, they should be filled with questions, but if they're afraid to ask them, you can tell something's a little bit off.
There's all of the doctrine that is traumatizing, but also what I think can be so traumatizing in YWAM is just the experiences. So my very first discipleship training school, again, I was 18 years old, and half of my outreach was in Thailand, working in the red light district where women and children were being sex trafficked. And the things that we saw and the experiences we had were terrifying and just excruciating. And I came back and I was still an 18-year-old girl. And so my high school friends are talking about their boy crushes and I'm just staring at them like, I don't even know how to relate to you anymore. And I think being able to have some curiosity around that and just the different types of trauma that is often experienced on outreach, stepping into places that I don't think 18 and 19 year olds should be stepping into in the first place.
Well, hopefully this has helped somebody. Like I said, I get a lot of questions about trying to discover how to help a family member if they've been trapped in a cult. And We've recently received quite a few about youth with a mission, but it really globally applies. Everything that we have talked about here, no matter which group you've been involved with, whether destructive or not, even if you're going to a mainstream church, I've been to some that were just a little bit off, and you can find yourself in a situation where you might have been negatively impacted. I'll just say it like that. And it really applies to whatever group that the person has been in. So hopefully we've said something that can help satisfy the curiosity from the parents and give some comfort to those who are struggling.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you so much for this conversation, John. I think it's really important.
Absolutely. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and indwellmovement.com. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.